Okay, so I thought it'd be fun to do a little kind of thought experiment to start here. Now, I want you to ask yourself, just silently, what emotion would you say that you feel the most often? If you think through your days, you think through your life, is there one emotion that you would say you feel the most often? Now, at the end of last week's talk, the reason I bring this up, at the end of last week's talk, during the question and answer, it came up that an important skill these days is for us to develop emotional maturity and emotional awareness. And for those of us who can develop it, it's those who are really good at it. They tend to get the promotions to jobs like manager and stuff like that. To be a good manager, you really need to be good with emotions, your own emotions, emotional self-regulation, you know, awareness of other people's emotions. It's like people skills. Okay, so now, all right, so hopefully you have thought of some emotion. And now there's, you know, the whole point of being Buddhist, the whole point of all this meditating we do and making merit, we want to be happy, right? We want to be peaceful, and hopefully we can even attain Nibbana, best of all, or go to a heavenly rebirth where it's very happy there all the time. So we, as Buddhists, are very interested in happiness. There was a interesting psychology study done. It's on the internet. And some psychologists, they wrote an app and they got 10,000 people to install the app. And the app would ask them several times a day, what emotion are you feeling right now? And it gave them kind of a list of emotions to choose from. So this app would keep track of, you know, kind of what their emotional state was. Then send the results back to the psychologists. So the psychologists are very proud. They got 10,000 people to take this study. That's actually a big crowd. That's a big number of people. And when they were finished, it turns out the most common emotion is joy. Joy is the most common emotion, apparently. The second most common emotion was love. The third most common emotion was anxiety. Anxiety. And one of the interesting findings as well was the positive emotions tended to be, if you just took an average, you know, totally average person, the positive emotions tended to outweigh the negative emotions by about 2 to 1. Okay, so, you know, for every, let's say, 2 hours that they were happy, they were unhappy somehow for 1 hour. You know, some, maybe they were anxious for 1 hour or whatever. Something, you know, maybe sad or angry or something negative. 2 to 1, positive to negative. So I found that super interesting. Super interesting. I'm like, what? Joy is the most common emotion? Like, I don't know about you, but whenever I go on the internet, oh, it's like all negative. It's pretty much all negative. you know, when you look at the news, you know, they tell you about different wars and politics and, you know, all kinds of problems. So, you know, yeah, there's way more negativity, at least wherever I look. I don't know about you, but when I go on the internet, yeah, it's mostly negative. Any kind of social media. That tends to attract the most attention, is by trying to kind of shout out about some sort of problems in the world. So I would invite you to think over, you know, when you go on, wherever you go, you know, maybe it's at Facebook or TikTok or wherever you go, maybe just tune into, like, what's the emotion here, though, you know? What is the sentiment? They use this word, sentiment, to mean, like, the emotional tone, okay? Is this, like, a happy posting? Oh, look at my funny cat, you know? Oh, look at my cute dog or whatever. It's something happy. Or is it, like, oh, we're in trouble. Oh, there's, you know, there's a war. There's the environment. Oh, no. Just, you know, have a look at the sentiment. Is it positive or negative? And I feel it's a worthwhile exercise to just ask oneself, you know, how much of my day do I spend in some sort of positive state compared to something negative? Even if it's just anxiety or something like that. And yeah, it's very emotionally expensive to look at social media if it's just going to pull down our mood. You know, all this anger, all this, you know, it's very expensive to our emotions. So in Buddhism, we have this word piti. Piti, which is like joy, sometimes also translated as rapture. Now, sometimes piti is used in a context where it's like the emotion of joy in this study, this psychology study. But sometimes it's kind of like almost a Brahma Vihara as well. Sometimes it's kind of similar to loving kindness or compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. You know, there's classically like four Brahma Viharas, okay? Metta, Karuna, Mudita, Upeka. But then piti is kind of off to the side. Is it an emotion or is it a Brahma Vihara? Well, it's kind of on the border, I would say. Sometimes it's a Brahma Vihara, but sometimes it's just an emotion. Depends on the context, wherever you find it in the suttas. So yeah, what confused me when I heard this study, I'm like, wait a minute though, isn't... The Buddha said, you know, dukkha, everything's dukkha, it's all suffering. But if piti, you know, if joy is the most common emotion, where's all this suffering? But when we look closer at the teaching of dukkha, he's mostly talking about those times in our life that are really, really hard on us. You know, maybe a loved one has died or something. Let's say our parents die, mother and father might die, or, you know, brother or sister dies, relatives die. Maybe we get sick, face our own death. You know, it's these really difficult times of life. That's really what dukkha is about. As a teaching. And can we use our practice? Can we use mindfulness? Can we transcend the suffering from these hardest times. And there's also dukkha in the sense that if one keeps being reborn again and again in samsara, one keeps facing one's death again and again, and one keeps facing the death of, let's say, you know, wife or husband, you know, mother, father, sisters and brothers, this kind of thing. It's kind of depressing to think if we keep getting reborn, we keep facing these difficult, really, really difficult times of suffering. But day to day, hopefully it's piti, hopefully it's joy, the number one emotion. I'm a bit of an amateur psychologist. I love it when they find interesting things like this. So there was another study where some psychologists noticed, this one's more recent, some psychologists noticed that, what's up with all this negativity on social media? You know, all this politically charged kind of, it's like there's all these people with this agenda to push really angry narratives, you know, about political things or all the problems in the world. Like, what's up with this? And they were able to follow the habits of a whole bunch of people who post on social media. Okay, so they had a bunch of people take this study who post on social media. And they observed what sort of postings they did. You know, the sentiment of the postings. Were they the more happy kind or maybe the more angry kind of posting? They would kind of look at the sentiment. And they also were able to do some quick analysis of each person's personality. They were able to fairly decently measure their how intelligent are they, and have they got any personality traits like they wanted to see if they would find any weird personality traits. You know, is there any patterns here? Are there some kind of bad personalities which were linked with these more angry kind of posts, these more sensationalized posts? They were wondering what personality types tend to make those posts. And what they found, the people who tend to post those angriest posts, you know, like, oh, there's those people being murdered in that other country, and if you don't protest against this, you support the murderers. No, actually, you are one of the murderers because you're tolerating this. You're a murderer. You know, stuff like this. You know, really rough, you know, really nasty kind of stuff, right? They portray it in this very black and white kind of way, you know. You are on our side or you're one of the bad guys, and it's one of the two, you know. Very polarizing. So the people who tended to make those kind of posts, they tended to be quite high in psychopathy personality trait, okay? Like they have more psychopath in their personality. There was a strong link between having psychopath in one's personality and making those kind of posts. And low intelligence. The people making those really black and white kind of posts, really, polarizing kind of posts, they tend to have low intelligence as well. So this was the strongest finding. This was the strongest finding in the study. Um, By the way, there is one social media network that I am on. I'm not on Facebook to speak of. I have a user account. Like, I might visit there once a month, once every 2 months. Never post anything. I'm not on, like, X or Twitter. I'm not on TikTok. I'm not on Instagram. Not on LinkedIn. I'm not on any of those commercial ones, if I can help it. The one that I'm on is called Mastodon, and it's this small one where all the computer geeks go. It's just for geeks and nerds, pretty much. It's like 90% for geeks, okay? But the one awesome thing that I like about it is you can mute people, and you can also block people. So if anybody starts, you know, kind of screaming and shouting about something, you know, like the tone of voice is really nasty. It's like abusive. It's like I'm being psychologically abused as soon as I hear it. Mute. I mute that person right away. Like, they're gone. Mute. And I'll never hear them again. It's like mute infinite time. You can set the time amount as well. You can mute them for a week or a month or, you know, infinite means forever. So I'm like, mute infinite, boom, gone. Yeah, so I probably have to mute someone, one person a day, maybe, on there. Now, if somebody begins to argue with me in this very toxic way, then you can block them, which is one more step worse, where no matter what that person says at me, if I have followers, the followers don't even hear that either. The blocking is so strong that even my followers don't hear what that person said. You know, if that person starts saying bad things about me, my followers won't hear it. So I hardly ever use that one. But I tend to avoid trying to argue with anybody. You know, if somebody's all like angry and, you know, you can see what their view is. You can see what they want to push. And I don't even want to argue with that because they've already made their mind up what they're going to say and what they're going to argue for. There's no changing their mind. It's just like block. So yeah, whatever social media network you're on, I sure hope it has something like this where you can mute people and block them. And I say, we need these features now. We need them, you know. Yeah. If only to preserve our emotional well-being, okay? To preserve our happiness. To even have an average amount of happiness. Joy has to be our number one emotion. That's just to be average, okay? We as Buddhists would prefer to even be better than average, okay? Better than average. I say we must learn to defend our emotional well-being this way. So yeah, there was a little more in that study as well. I think I can dwell on it for another few minutes. So that was the strongest pattern where, you know, psychopaths with low intelligence, they're making those nastiest posts. Now, a little bit less strong of a pattern, but still noticeable in the study, is also narcissists make those sorts of posts as well. And when those narcissists come from the USA, it correlates with low intelligence. But when those narcissists come from China, it correlates with high intelligence. There's narcissists in China who make these political posts as well, and they have high intelligence. So this, you know, they also could break it down by region as well. This is very interesting. Anyway, I just find this stuff interesting. Okay, now I want to share with you a little bit about my own journey to having more joy in my life, okay? Now, of course, you know, when you're ordained as a Buddhist monk, when you live in the monastery, you obviously, practice meditation, lots of sitting meditation, walking meditation. Ideally, we attain to the jhanas or samadhi, deep meditation, very blissful. And even when we are around other people, hopefully we can get some kind of a Brahma Vihara, maybe loving kindness. It's hard to do. But that's someone who's a very mature practitioner can do this. They can break through the Brahma Viharas, not just in sitting or walking meditation, but even around other people. I would say that's the hardest challenge of all. Can we do it around other people? Okay, so that's kind of the training over the years. As the years pass, one gains more proficiency in this. And there's also this strong theme as well in monastic life of simplify your life, okay? Live simply. Whenever you see Buddhist monks, they're almost, they serve as an example of what simple living looks like, okay? My haircut's so simple, I just shave my head, totally bald. I never have to think about what hairstyle. It's the same one every time. Just shaved right off. Okay, I don't think about which clothes I'm going to put on today. It's always a robe every time. I don't think of my shoes. I just wear the same sandals. So I say there's a lot to praise when it comes to looking for simplicity in life, where I would argue that we can have more joy in our life when we have more simplicity. Okay. Now I'm from the Theravada, tradition of Buddhism. I tend to study the early Buddhist texts the most. But once in a while, the Mahayana have this some sort of awesome phrase, some awesome teaching. When I hear about it, I'm like, oh, that one's so good. I can't resist. It's sometimes the Mahayana really nail it. Okay, so there was this, there's this saying that I learned. It comes from kind of like this poem written by one of the Mahayana kind of patriarch, kind of lineage holding, super senior monks. So he wrote this poem, and one of the lines really stuck with me. Make any distinction whatsoever, and heaven and earth are set far apart. Okay, I'll say it again. Make any distinction whatsoever, and heaven and earth are set far apart. So it sounds kind of confusing, it's almost like a riddle. Like, what do they mean, Heaven and earth being pulled apart? What do you mean? Some kind of a distinction? What kind of distinction? That could mean a lot of things, What do you mean by distinction? That could mean anything, really. Any distinction. And when I read that, I'm like, you could not possibly say that if you weren't like a meditation master. You could not possibly say that if you had not been meditating a very long time. This is the kind of thing a master would say. It's no surprise that was like a lineage holding, super senior monk. That was, to my mind, that is a genius statement. It's a genius statement. Even though it sounds like a riddle, the more you practice over time, the more that you will see how that is an extremely true statement. Extremely true statement. Once in a while, we Westerner monks will read not just psychology type stuff, but once in a while, like neuroscience type stuff. A really good book will come by. And there was this one book that several monks were all recommending that I knew, just kind of privately recommending to each other. So this book is called The Master and His Emissary by Ian McGilchrist. The Master and His Emissary. And so he's like a brain scientist, a neuroscientist. And he was explaining how there is some pretty big differences with how the left hemisphere of our brain works and the right hemisphere of our brain works. And at any given time, we're probably using one side more than the other, okay? It's not like one half shuts off and the other one turns on, and the other one shuts off and the other one turns on. It's not one at a time. But one of them can be kind of more predominant, you know? We're using it more than the other. So the right hemisphere of the brain, when we use that one more, that is where all the happiness tends to be, okay? That's where all the, we're going to feel the PT, we're going to feel joy, we're going to feel love, we're going to feel all these nice emotions, okay? There's going to be nice hormones like oxytocin and serotonin. It's all these like kind of happy juices, you know, they're like hormones. It's over in the right hemisphere of the brain where we feel that more. It's the side of our brain which is more, when we feel connected in this whole way, okay? So right now I'm sitting at the front of the room. If I open up my vision really wide out to the sides and see right up to the sides, the whole room, and see right to the ceiling, right to the floor, okay? I just see the whole thing at once. And I'm not like picking out particular people. Okay, when I just see the whole thing, a big picture, that is a very right hemisphere way to do it. Okay? It's like be part of the whole. Just lose yourself in the whole experience. And I would say a lot of the Buddha's teachings on meditation want to take us there, where we feel this sense of wholeness and we lose our sense of self. Okay? This teaching of anatta, non-self. You know, we partakes of this. Now, when we use our left hemisphere of our brain more, that is a very, what it's good at is like logical thinking, logical reasoning, okay, rational thinking, linear thinking, analyzing things, problem solving, okay, like if you want to solve a math problem, you know, what's 9 times 13? What's 9 times 13? Does anybody know? Okay, well, to answer that, it's you had to use your left hemisphere of your brain. It's 117. Anyway, but it's not fun to do math, okay? It's not fun. There's like no happy juices there, you know? There's no... The more we use our minds in these logical ways, it's good for solving problems, but that's not any happy way to live, okay? And the author of this book, Ian McGilchrist, he's like, if you wanted happiness in your life, go to the right hemisphere as much as you can. Okay, like, Yeah, in the right hemisphere, it's more like creative. It's more artsy. It's more connected to everyone else. It's more socially connected. It's more emotionally connected. That's where all the people skills open up. It's in the right hemisphere. So let me return back to this phrase. Make any distinction whatsoever, and heaven and earth are set far apart. So that was written hundreds of years ago. Okay, there was no neuroscience yet. There was no knowledge of, you know, left hemisphere and right hemisphere or brain or whatever. But that is true and accurate in that whenever we use our minds in this analytical way, a focused way, okay? By the way, whenever I focus my eyes on something very specifically, you know, like that bottle on the floor, okay, or that camera at the back of the room, or the clock on the wall, I focus in on things, that's very left hemisphere. It's very left hemisphere. It makes distinctions, okay? There's a distinct bottle there, and I'm ignoring the rest of the room. There's a distinct clock there, and I'm ignoring the rest of the room. A distinct camera. I'm like selecting the objects. That's very left hemisphere. And the more I do that, the more I won't have joy in my life. I won't have happiness. Okay, so when I have a lot of joy, a lot of happiness, it's like I'm in heaven. And I feel connected to everyone, the whole room, you know, the whole experience. It's just one big experience, and I just melt into it. Yeah, it's like heavenly. Okay? Make any distinction, and heaven and earth are set far apart. So if you want to be happy, you want to be joyous, you need to figure out how to get to the right hemisphere more. Okay? And meditation can do that. I especially like using awareness of body myself. I also like doing a little trick I do where I try to see as much as I can at once. So I'm wearing glasses right now. And I try to even see outside the sides of my glasses, like outside the frames, even above my glasses, below my glasses, like, you know, like I see the frame of my glasses in front of my face, and I'm seeing around my glasses, okay? It's a little trick if you wear glasses. Okay, can you see out the sides and above and below, like totally open up? And I also like to have an awareness of the space as well. Just a sense of the space. The Buddha does teach these objects of meditation, but you do need to know where to look in the suttas. It's only mentioned a little bit here and there. It's there, but it's kind of a more minor teaching. Anyway, that's what I've found works the best for me. And it kind of gets me into that joyous state much easier. If I'm alone in my kuti, let's say, I try to see the entire room at once. Even those little objects here and there, I try not to look at the specific objects, but rather see the whole room. And then just relax into the moment, you know? Relax into the present moment. I received the advice as well that helped me a lot, which went, how much more joy would I have in my life if I was only willing to just pause a little bit more? If I could just slow down a bit, if I could just pause a little bit more, how much more joy could I find? And I had to admit there were actually many occasions where joy was not far away. Joy was not hard to find, but I had to slow down just a little bit. I had to stop myself, like, why am I rushing here? Why am I hurrying here? Can't I just slow down a little bit and enjoy the moment? And just by slowing down for like 5 seconds sometimes, 2 seconds, that was enough. Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, there's the joy. It's like I was rushing past it, you know? I was like outrunning it. I was running one step or two ahead of it. Because I was going just a little too fast. A little too impatient. I just have to slow down a bit. Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, there it is, right there. And I kind of felt stupid, like, why was I denying myself? Why did I have to save those 2 seconds? You know, did I really have to save those 5 seconds? No. Yeah. So I'll say it one more time. Hopefully you remember. Make any distinction whatsoever, and heaven and earth are set far apart. I feel that that also kind of connects with a theme of simplicity. Meaning, like, can we leave things simple? The more we leave things simple, the more we don't steal the happiness away from ourselves, because there are things we make distinctions about. You know what I mean? Whenever there's a lack of simplicity and things are more complicated, those complicated details end up being distinctions that we can get stuck on, and then we lose our joy. It's just that there was distinctions at all, that there was details at all, that there was complications at all, that can steal our happiness away. Just because we got stuck on those details. So to my mind, all this simplicity which Buddhism teaches is in service of that. Okay? That's the benefit of all this simplicity. By kind of reducing the details, reducing the complexity, reducing the complications, then there's just fewer of these distinctions which grab our attention and take away our happiness, take away our joy. So yeah, it's been a long journey for me, a long journey to see the wisdom of I'm going to say, maybe not avoiding details, that's going a little too far, okay? But I will say eschewing details. There's this fancy English word I quite like, to eschew. It's like a verb, to eschew, E-S-C-H-E-W. Eschew means like to prefer not to. It's kind of a strong preference not to. Okay, so maybe I will eschew eating dairy products because I'm lactose intolerant. I will try to avoid them. If I eat, you know, milk or cheese or yogurt, I get my skin breaks out. I will eschew it. But then someone will come along with a pizza that they donate, and I'm like, oh, but how do I say no to a pizza? Oh, you know? So yeah, then I look like a hypocrite. I eat my pizza, get you know, a few pimples or whatever. You know, so I eschew the dairy. I avoid it by default. But there is those rare occasions, yeah, okay, I can't help myself. I'll eat pizza, you know. So that's not, I don't absolutely avoid it. But I do eschew it, okay? So it means like avoid by default, you know, prefer avoiding, okay? So in this same way, I feel if we're wise, you know, Buddhism will try to teach this lesson to us in 100 ways. We wish to eschew complexity, okay? Reduce complexity. Reduce complications in our life. But, hey, sometimes you can't get rid of every complication in your life. It's not fair to expect that, you know. Sometimes you have to face complications. You have to face unpleasant details or whatever. Sometimes life is a bit messy, you know. We have a saying in English, to get our hands dirty, okay? Sometimes you got to get your hands dirty. Like there's some messy problem, you got to get your hands dirty. Let's say nobody's cleaned the sink in a week or two, and there's this scummy layer at the bottom of the sink and nobody wants to clean it, you know? Well, sometimes you got to get your hands dirty. Someone's got to go in there and clean it, right? Now, somebody who's a little too aggressive with this, and they're like, no, like, I insist on total simplicity. I insist that my life is so simple that I don't even clean the sink. Okay, well, that's going too far, right? We can't leave this dirty sink forever, right? So there is a limit. There is a limit here, you know. So someone who never wants to clean the sink, they don't want to get their hands dirty. Okay, please don't be like that. Don't be one of those people who never wants to get their hands dirty, letting other people take care of it. Ah, somebody else will do it. I have some kind of a servant or some assistant or whatever, they'll do it. I say, don't go that far. People who always want to keep their hands clean, like, it's possible to get that way so much it's like toxic behavior. Please don't do that. Okay, so we eschew complications, but sometimes we have to get our hands dirty.